So, first things first, I am a politician and I am behind a pulpit. I know that's kind of strange for some people, but it's a real thing. And politicians can be Christians. Isn't that amazing? And just so you know, I do run a little sarcastic, so feel free to laugh and feel free to, you know, be interactive, because I kind of believe that that's the best way to fellowship, is to talk to each other and just have a conversation. But I want to just tell you a little bit about who I am, what I'm doing, and I want to be an encouragement to you as a fellow believer. First thing that you should know is I am a believer. I have a personal relationship with Jesus Christ, and I know that he is the only way that we get from here to there. And that is the first thing that you need to know about me. But I grew up in a Christian family. I'm from Lisbon Falls, Maine. When I was 4 days old, my mom, freshly out of the hospital, brought me to Lisbon Falls Baptist Church to have my first church service. My family believes in the local church. They believe in a personal relationship with Jesus Christ. And that's how I got my start. From kindergarten all the way to my senior year of high school, I went to Calvary Christian Academy. It's a small Christian school in Turner, Maine. Well, I went to the same school whole time. And from there, I went to Pensacola Christian College, graduated with a degree. Well, first, I'll be honest with you. The first thing I did was I went to be an elementary education teacher. And I loved it. I loved teaching the kids. It was awesome. But then I had my first parent-teacher conference. And I realized that a career in education had to deal with parents. And I didn't want to do that. I do believe that God has a sometimes sick sense of humor. You fast forward to where I am now, and now I'm the majority leader of the state senate, and I lead 17 other adults in a classroom setting. So I got to give up the kids, but I gained all the adults. That's all right. But I think God has a laugh about stuff like that sometimes. Ended up getting a degree in business, and somewhere along the line, I fell in love with the world of sports management. Now, I love sports. I am a horrible athlete. My sister got every ounce of athleticism in our entire gene pool. She's owned multiple CrossFit gyms and placed in the Northeast region, 11th place for women. I can't do anything. I have arthritis in my right wrist, so, I mean, I just didn't get what she got. But anyways, so I fell in love with sports management, figured out that these teams needed people to run them. The athletes weren't the ones selling the tickets and the hot dogs and the advertising. There was people behind the scenes doing that. So I pursued an internship with the Portland Sea Dogs, ended up getting a job with them, and I spent a full year really living a dream. It was totally awesome. And if I would have spent one more month with the Portland Sea Dogs, I would have had a World Series ring in 2007. But I was foolish and I left. I'm not bitter about it, but I do think about it from time to time. Those things are $30,000, man. But I took a great job with the Lewiston Maniacs, and the Lewiston Maniacs were a member of the Quebec Major Junior Hockey League. I spent 2 years traveling all over North America, recruiting hockey players, getting them to come play for us. And in 2007, I actually became president of the club. So I was 23 years old, and I became the youngest hockey executive in North America. I was sitting at tables with NHL Hall of Famers, making decisions about hockey, and I had truly thought that I'd reached the pinnacle of what I was supposed to be doing. I was able to have some players live in my house. Some of them were Christians, some of them were not. And I really believed that what I was doing was what I was supposed to be doing here on earth. And at that time, it was. But not too long into my tenure as president of the club, I had my first brush with how the government can not only interfere in your personal life, but it can interfere in your business life as well. And the government had passed a tax on entertainment, so they taxed me at 5% on my hockey ticket sales. I should mention, my cousin Dale is with me tonight. He's right back there. And he was kind of the instigator in me running for office for the first time. Because I was complaining to him about the stupid legislature and why they passed certain bill. And he goes, well, why don't you do something about it? And by the end of the conversation, I was running for the state senate. Now, when you run for office, there's people at the top that are making decisions about you. So there's three tiers of candidates. There's the first tier, which is the people who we really need to keep there if we want any semblance of a caucus in the legislature. There's a second tier, which is the people which, if things get interesting, we might start spending some money on you. And then there's a third tier, which I like to call the thank you for trying tier. And those are the people that get the participation trophy at the end of the year and say, good on ya. That's where I was. Nobody really thought that we could win that first race, but Dale and I spent countless hours, knocked on over 10,000 doors in that first race, and on election night, we won that race so convincingly that we were the first race called on election night. It was a lot of hard work, but it was a lot of prayer from a lot of different people too, and little did I know that I was going to be serving in the state senate. Since that time, I've been elected three more times, and the past 3 years I've served as majority leader of the state senate, and I was given that title by a caucus whose average age is over 60 years old. They elected a 32-year-old to be their leader twice. I'm ever grateful and thankful for that. We've done some amazing things. We've reduced taxes not just for the rich, not just for the poor, not just for the middle class, but for all Maine people. And we have done things like make sure that you have more options in educating your children through charter schools and further homeschool options. And I came from a Christian education background, so I believe in that. And making sure that that is available and accessible to all Maine people is important. We've also done things like rip Planned Parenthood money out of the budget, making sure that they don't get any more money from the state. I think that's a big win. But for all of the things that we've done, I really do believe that there's so much more to do. And that's why I'm running for governor. And obviously, am I here to get your support? I am. But I really am here to encourage you. Now, the first thing I want to say before I get into some more remarks is you need to be thankful for your pastor. It is not easy to allow a politician in this country access to a microphone in front of a church. Most politicians will just come in and they'll talk to you, say, hey, you know, how you doing? I'd like to get your vote. But to allow a politician to stand behind a pulpit and preach to you, teach you, give you encouragement, that's a whole other ball of wax. So be thankful for your pastor that he allowed me to do this, because that takes guts and bravery. Because in this country, the church has been lied to. The church has been told to sit down, be quiet, keep your thoughts in these four walls, and if you do, we will reward you with tax-exempt status. That's what the government has told us. That's not only is unconstitutional, but it came from a politician named Lyndon Johnson, who was president of the United States. And Senator Johnson at the time didn't like the fact that Baptist churches were telling people from the pulpit to not vote for Senator Johnson for a certain amount of reasons. So he put a bill in to a tax bill and said, if you continue to speak out, you will lose your tax-exempt status. Well, since that time, it's been repealed. President Trump actually repealed it last year, which we're thankful for that. But no church has ever lost their tax-exempt status. Not one church in the entire United States has ever lost it. The government brought one church to court and they lost. Those are the kind of lies that have been perpetrated about the church. So we have to stop, as Christians, believing that we have to be politically silent, because that's a lie. But if we're going to truly preach the gospel, would you agree with me that we have to preach the entire gospel? When we censor the gospel, you lose the message every single time. So if we believe we must preach the full gospel, we have to talk about politics. You see, because the Bible is a very political book. It's been burned. it's been treated as treasonous. Kings and queens have written Bibles in their own words, in their own tongue, to get their message across. The Bible has been used in so many political ways, it's not even funny, but it has always endured. And that political message is still there today. You see, when we open the Bible, we start reading about people, and we tell our children, we tell each other, you need to be like these people in the Bible, and we lay out a bunch of people. And we talk about how they served God or they didn't serve God, or they walked in the Spirit or they didn't. But we forget about inherently who many of these people were. They were politicians. I want to talk to you a little bit tonight about some of my favorite politicians in the Bible and some of the lessons that we can learn from them. So my favorite politician in the Bible is Esther. And the reason is because she was an unknowing and unwitting politician. Now, I have won a close election in my time. In 2012, I won an election by 27 votes out of 21,000 votes cast. It was not a comfortable 2 weeks for me as we waited for recounts. But Esther probably won one of the ugliest elections. She had to win it through a beauty contest. And not just a one-night beauty contest, it was a one-year beauty contest. I will admit to you that a win is a win, and I'll take it when I can get it. But I'm not willing to go take that win. I'm just not. But we know the story of Esther. Esther saved her people from genocide. But we forget some of the small pieces of what Esther did when she first became queen. So when Esther becomes queen, the typical setup for a coronation ceremony was the king and queen and their family on stage, everybody else, the court was on the bottom, you know, having their feast, drinking, dancing, all of that stuff that happens at a coronation feast. That's what history tells us. History also tells us that the queen, the new queen, would be granted something from the king. And the king would give that either to the people or to the court, whatever the queen desired. So Esther, in Esther 2:18, and I don't think I brought my Bible up here. Josh, you want to come bring me my Bible? Turn in your Bible to Esther 2:18. And I'm going to be reading out of the English Standard tonight, just so you know. So in Esther 2:18, it talks about that coronation feast that I was talking about earlier. So this is Esther's gift to the people. Esther 2:18 says, Then the king gave a great feast for all his officials and servants. It was Esther's feast. Here's the point. He also granted a remission of taxes to the provinces and gave gifts with royal generosity. The first thing on Esther's mind was give the people a tax cut. You know, as Christians, we think that we are relegated to social issues and issues of morality. But all issues are Christian issues. All of them. You see, when Esther saved her people from genocide, that's great, but she also had her eye on the policy ball as well. In the United States, we have the incredible opportunity to not only decide who Caesar is, but we also get to decide how much Caesar charges us to be citizens. They didn't have that opportunity in that day, so think about it in that frame of mind as well. They didn't have the ability to choose who their king and queen was. They didn't have the ability to choose how much they paid in taxes and vote people out when time came. But Esther knew that that money was better held in the people's pocket than hers. Esther's my favorite politician for many reasons, and that's one of them. Now, it's election day 2018. I want you to envision the choices you have on a ballot. Pretend I'm not running, okay? So one of the choices that you have is a guy who's the best foreign policy that he has to offer is to bomb everything, murder, kill every man, woman, and child in the country, take it all, take all the spoils of war for himself, and that's the best thing we ought to do in regards to foreign policy. He also has a history. And the history is that he had his top general killed because he was having an affair with that guy's wife. And then he married that woman and had a family with her. Would you vote for that guy? Would anybody vote for that guy? Probably not. Did you say yes? Yeah. He knows where I'm going with this. That man is David. That man is King David. I think in politics, sometimes we hold politicians to an unachievable standard. And while it's important to vet politicians and make sure that we know who we're voting for, we also have to remember that all is not lost if your guy doesn't get in. All right? David was a man after God's own heart. That's what the Bible says. But he messed up constantly. He messed up all the time. But God still has his hand on him because he tried hard. He messed up. But read the Psalms. Read about the repentance of David. Because he always knew when he messed up. And David, this is also worth noting. There is only one group of people in the Bible that God talks about that he literally moves their decision making, and that's politicians. I think sometimes we lose hope and there's a guy that gets in office that we might not like and we might not agree with, and he might not be a godly man or a God-fearing man at all. But we must never lose sight that we serve the greatest king and the one who is actually controlling that politician's decision-making. Proverbs tells us that. Proverbs tells us that God is still on the throne, he's the one making the decisions, and that we can rest in that. And that is so, so, so important to remember. As we move further through the Bible, we come across probably the most famous politician, and that's Jesus Christ himself. Now, Jesus was the consummate politician. He was the ultimate politician. And people think, well, oh, yeah, he's making some point about how we're all politicians. No, I'm not. Jesus was actually a politician. And we start to see first how he got there when Jesus was 12 years old debating in the temple. You see, you couldn't just walk in there and do that. You had to earn that right through education, through training. And I believe that's what Jesus was working towards, because you fast forward, and we don't know about anything about Jesus through his teenage years and into his 20s, but you fast forward through all of that, and Jesus is called Rabbi. Now, Rabbi was also a title that wasn't given to just anybody. You had to earn it. Just like you can't just go around and start saying, I'm Senator so-and-so, and never win an election. You have to earn that title. You have to get elected. Same thing with the title rabbi. And rabbis were given political powers by the Roman government. So the Roman emperor, only to Israel, gave the power to rabbis to implement Jewish justice and Roman justice, which included prison terms and it included crucifixion. Rabbis had unique authority in the Roman Empire. And Jesus achieved that. So, I'll do another Bible verse here. Matthew 17. So many times in the Bible, Jesus is making both a political and a spiritual point at the same time. And this is one of them. How many of you have ever been to Israel before? Oh, a lot of you. That's awesome. How many have been to Herodium? Anybody know Herodium in the Judean desert? Okay, perfect. I get to surprise all of you. I've been there. So Herodium is a national park in the West Bank, and it's in the middle of the Judean desert. And King Herod built fortresses and castles all over Israel because he liked to be in a bunch of different places. There's three of them in particular note. One, he had a palace in Jerusalem near the temple. Two, he had one near the Dead Sea at Masada, which is some fascinating Jewish history reading if you'd like to read that on your own time. The third one was Herodium. And Herod loved the solitude of the Judean desert. And he wanted to rule from that place. But he wanted to be able to see Jerusalem from his new castle in Herodium. And his architect said, you can't see Jerusalem from here. It's not possible. And they said, well, he goes, you better figure out a way to do it. So what they did, and remember, this is Jesus' day. They blew the top off a mountain. Then they built another mountain on top of that mountain. And they built a castle on top of that. This was the seat of Roman power in Israel at the time of Jesus. This is where business got done. So you walk in there, and there's a giant pool. There's a pool that would put any sandals resort to shame. And that was kind of the area where everything got done. And remember, this is in the middle of the desert. The middle of the desert, absolutely amazing thing. This is also where Jesus healed the epileptic boy. That's where this happened. So let's read this story, and I'm going to tell you why it's important. Starts in verse 14. And when they came to the crowd, a man came up to him and said, kneeling before him, Lord, have mercy on my son, for he is an epileptic, and he suffers terribly, for often he falls into the fire and often into the water. And I brought him to your disciples, and they could not heal him. And Jesus answered, O faithless and twisted generation, how long am I to be with you? How long am I to bear with you? Bring him here to me. And Jesus rebuked the demon, and it came out of him. And the boy was healed instantly. Then the disciples came to Jesus privately and said, why could we not cast it out? And he said to them, because of your little faith, for truly I say to you, if you have faith like a grain of mustard seed, you will say to this mountain, move from here to there, and it will move, and nothing will be impossible for you. So a couple of things to note here. A grain of mustard seed. Do you know what grows on the side of Herodium? Mustard plants. So I can just imagine Jesus grabbing a mustard flower, squeezing it, and a bunch of mustard seeds coming out. And mustard seeds are really small. And if you want to see a picture of them afterwards, I'd be happy to show you on my phone. But mustard seeds are so small. So Jesus is making the point of how little your faith has to be. Now remember, this was the seat of Roman government. The Jews hated the Romans. Hated the Roman government. They were looking for the Messiah. They were looking for the Yeshua HaMashiach, and they thought, at this point, the Jewish people, rabbis, Sadducees, and Pharisees thought this could be the guy. This Jesus could be the Messiah. It wasn't too long after this that they started, that Palm Sunday happened, and they were welcoming him in as king. They thought this guy was coming in to take the Romans out and set up the millennial reign on earth. They missed a couple of steps in between. But they did think it was Jesus. They were thinking it was him. Then what does the Bible say? It says, if you had just that little bit of faith, Jesus using a little object lesson, you could take this mountain and you could throw it off. Jesus was making a political point that if you have a little bit of faith, you can make massive political change. But he was also making a spiritual point. Jesus was a politician. And he knew what was going on during his time. He was aware and he was knowledgeable of it. And he was teaching his disciples that in that moment. We must continue to pay attention to the world around us because it matters. it matters what's going on in Augusta. And yes, Augusta's 3 hours away from here. And sometimes I would imagine you feel very disconnected from Augusta. I do when I only live a half hour away. But it is our responsibility to affect change in the best possible way that we can as Christians, as believers, and as informed American citizens. So I want to tell you a story about my first week in the legislature. I didn't know what was going on. I was just happy to be there. And Dale and I and a couple of other people went around and we went to the state archives. And the state archivist was just surprised that anybody would even come to the state archives, let alone a bunch of legislators. But we went and I said, you gotta have some cool stuff around here. Can you show us some things? So he brought us down 3 floors below the ground. And down there, there's a safe. And in that safe are Maine's most precious documents. So there's a copy of there's the original copy of the Constitution that's written on lambskin. Beautiful calligraphy. There's a letter from George Washington to Benedict Arnold, who was patrolling the northern border of Maine during the Revolution. There's a copy of, well, there is the original letter of, President Monroe, a letter to William King, the first governor of Maine, saying that Maine had become an independent state from Massachusetts. And then, as I pulled open a drawer, there was what appeared to be a copy of the Declaration of Independence. Maine owns a copy of the Declaration of Independence. That is incredible. So how did we get this? Well, in 1776, a bunch of guys down in Philadelphia sent a letter off to King George III basically saying, stick it, we're done. Send that letter off, and all of these people, 13 colonies from Georgia all the way up to Maine, because we were part of Massachusetts at that time, we were a free and independent country. No longer did we pay homage to a king across an ocean. We were free, independent republic. So they had to figure out a way to get this message out, because that's probably pertinent information for the people that live in the colonies. So Ben Franklin had an idea, and he said, you can use my printing press, print off 300 copies of the Declaration of Independence, and put it on the church doors of 300 churches, largest churches in the colonies. That's what that hole was for at the top of the Declaration of Independence, because it was nailed to the front door of a church in Wiscasset. I'm going to go back to my original point. Ladies and gentlemen, if the church and Christians stayed silent in matters of politics, we would still be singing God Save the Queen. It's a fact. Because in churches, all of the important and pertinent information of elections and town halls and town business was done in a church. John Adams was elected to the Continental Congress at a church service. Second president of the United States running for office after church was over. The business of government started here. It started in the church. Ladies and gentlemen, we have a responsibility. We have a command. An example to follow. And being involved in civic engagement. Like I said at the beginning, am I here to get your vote? Yeah, I am. 100%. But I believe that God has given me an opportunity to travel the state. We're in a different church every Sunday. Sunday morning, Sunday night, we talk to a different church. And I believe God has given me a unique opportunity to not only campaign across the state, but to talk to churches and make sure that you are doing your duty as a Christian and being salt and light in the world, in every area including government. We must preach the whole gospel. We must. And Jesus talks so much about our place in the world and where we belong. So I would love to have your support, but I would like even more for your engagement. And my team's here. Boys are right there. Dale and Jody. We're collecting $5 contributions for my campaign. We'd love your help in that. If you want to go on our email list, we got a list for you to join on that. If you just want to chat with me and ask me a few questions afterwards, I'd be happy to answer them. But my ask for you tonight as your brother in Christ is pay attention. Know what you're voting on. Know who you're voting for. There are 60 million evangelical Christians in America. In the 2012 election, only 25% of them voted. And of those, about 60% of them voted for the candidate that most lined up with evangelical Christian values. That means 40% did not. If every evangelical Christian in America voted their values, it wouldn't be a contest. It wouldn't even be close. If they just showed up and voted for the person that most lined up with them, we would never have a problem with legislation and that runs afoul of what we believe and know to be right. So I'll leave it there. And I thank you for your time. Thank you for your pulpit. And I hope that I can get your vote.